Good evening. You are listening to the Elchar Chronicles. I'm your host, Karen Elchar. This program chronicles issues of law and order and our local justice system, the environment, and Indigenous issues with special guests that dig deep into topics less talked about here in the Lehigh Valley. This evening, I'm pleased to welcome three returning guests from Penn Environment Research and Policy Center to discuss the latest developments on Pennsylvania conservation connectivity, including wildlife corridors, plastics, and the Pellet Free Waters Act, and renewable energy projects such as wind and solar. My first guest is Ms. Stephanie Wine, Penn Environment's Clean Water and Conservation Advocate. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Yes, it's always a pleasure. So I understand there's been movement on the wildlife corridor issue, and could you remind our listeners of the issues and talk about latest developments?
Yes, well, I can start by, pulling back, the 10,000-foot view of what habitat connectivity is and why it's important, and then I can share the exciting update that we've had over the last few months and where we see things going from here. So to understand why wildlife corridors are important, we first have to understand what habitat fragmentation is. So Pennsylvania's habitat, it's fragmented, and that threatens our wildlife. And so that means that habitats are broken up, making it difficult for our wildlife to migrate, to mate, to forage, to find each other, and it hurts our wildlife populations. Here in Pennsylvania, Penn's Woods, that's literally what our name is, from our elk and our bobcat and our bear to the billions of songbirds that move through the Commonwealth each year, we are blessed to be home to incredible native species. But every year, more and more of that habitat of Penn's Woods is crisscrossed by roads, by energy infrastructure like pipelines, and by sprawl. And so when you have this fragmented habitat, you might not actually be losing a lot of acreage of forest or of other types of habitat, but you're breaking it up, and that makes it harder for wildlife to use these landscapes and, like I said, to mate, migrate, to forage for their food. And this has a couple implications. First, it interrupts migration. Pennsylvania is important not just for our own native wildlife. We have hemispheric importance. We're a key part of something called the Atlantic Flyway, and that's the path along which billions of birds from Canada and the northern U.S. migrate down to the Gulf of Mexico and beyond. And so when our forests and meadows and wetland habitats are sliced up or destroyed, it threatens not only our resident birds, but species throughout the Western Hemisphere. Also, monarchs, these butterflies that make their multi-generational migration through North America to Mexico. And so when you break up this habitat in Pennsylvania, you actually impact birds from Mexico all the way up to Canada. Breaking up habitat, fragmented habitat, it also decreases resilience and the ability of our species to cope with climate change. So as our climate warms, the geography for a given species' ideal climate is shifting. So plant and animal ranges are chasing cooler temperatures, northwards in latitude, higher in altitude. So the Audubon Society actually projects a northward shift for basically all North American bird ranges in the coming years. But if habitat is broken up, it's really hard for animals to seek what we call climate refuges, to seek those cooler places where they can then, survive and thrive in a warmer climate. Habitat fragmentation also leads to inbreeding. So when wildlife populations are cut off from each other, they can't mate with each other. And so you have inbreeding generation after generation. You're going to have unhealthier populations that are less resistant to parasites and diseases and more vulnerable to natural disasters. So, for example, the bobcat that we have here in Pennsylvania, when they're cut off from one another by freeways, we save a lot of trouble crossing safely. We see more inbreeding, we see more health problems, and then we see lower survival rates. And then finally, crossing deaths in general. When habitats are bisected by roads, wildlife are struck by vehicles as they cross. And Pennsylvania, every year, is one of the top three states for animal vehicle collisions. Everyone, I think, has some story of either them or someone they love hitting a deer here in Pennsylvania, but it isn't just a deer problem. In 2021, over 500 black bear perished on Pennsylvania's roads, and 60 of our state's only 1,400 elk were killed by vehicles. Even our turtles, whose numbers are declining, they're frequent victims of traffic accidents as they move from pond to pond to breed. So that's the problem. Our habitats are being broken up by infrastructure. And then wildlife corridors, that is a broad term for a number of different strategies that, one, reconnect habitats across human infrastructure or prevent existing habitat from being fragmented in the face of development. And so they can look like a lot of different things. Road overpasses or underpasses to help, you know, bear and bobcat and deer get safely across our roads. But it also can look like a little culvert under a road, allowing amphibians or fish to pass under a road through a stream. It can also mean planting native plants in a strip of woodland connecting forests on either side of farmland. So if you go out into farm country, you'll often see these windbreaks planted between farm fields that help protect the crops. If those are widened and planted with native trees, those also can be really powerful corridors connecting wildlife up from habitat on one side of the property to the other. So even fish ladders, which help fish and otters navigate dams and move upstream, those all are types of wildlife corridors. So you think in Pennsylvania, where we have these incredible natural resources here in Penn's Woods and this huge problem of wildlife vehicle collisions, we would be a natural fit for having some sort of statewide habitat connectivity and wildlife corridor plan. But we don't. So for several years, Penn Environment has been hard at work with a bipartisan set of legislative champions working to lay the groundwork for Pennsylvania to start really looking at, from a 10,000-foot view, how we can best reconnect and preserve the connections within our wildlife habitat and prevent this problem of fragmentation. Last year, we were able to help pass House Resolution 87, which I know I came on your show to talk about very excitedly at the time. House Resolution 87 directed the House Legislative Budget and Finance Committee, the LBFC, this research bureau within the state, to study and issue a report on the status, management, and benefit of wildlife corridors. And so for the first time, the state was going to take a step back and look at how we can preserve habitat connectivity and reconnect where fragmentation has happened. And what was exciting was this had a lot of bipartisan support. It was championed by Representative Mary Jo Daly of Montgomery County, a Democrat, and Republican Jason Ortitai of Western Pennsylvania. And so now I can come to you a year later and say that that report is out. And so we have this now really great resource on what are the resources that already exist in Pennsylvania? What are we lacking? What are the places that need more focus? And a set of recommendations for both the governor and for our legislature, what they can do to start prioritizing habitat connectivity across all of our agencies and help us catch up with what other states are already doing.
So where would our listeners actually find the report?
It is on the Legislative Budget and Finance Committee's website. It's a little hard to find if you look up the title of the report, The Current Status of Conservation Connectivity in Pennsylvania. That's the title. You can also head to the Penn Environment website where we have some resources on this new report, because now the work is to make sure that this report isn't just another white paper that sits on the shelf. You know, we see this as not the end of the work, but the beginning of the work. We now have a little bit of a roadmap for how we can make this a priority as a state. And so us as advocates, our job now, and working with other, you know, we did not do this alone. We're working with groups like Pennsylvania Habitat Connectivity, the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Partnership with the Pennsylvania Federation of Sportsmen. There's a lot of groups who were supportive of this campaign. It's now our job to push for the report's recommendations to be brought to fruition. Mm. And so some of those recommendations include that the executive branch, the governor, Governor Shapiro, convene an official commission to make sure that the federal and the state partners and the nonprofit community, which, you know, has a lot of research and great conservation work already happening, to pull that together in a formal way to make sure that all the stakeholders are communicating and establish clear goals for habitat protection. So, for example, if you talk to our friends at PennDOT, which is responsible for you know, thousands of miles of roads. If you talk to the Game Commission, which controls millions of acres of state land, or the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, each of those agencies is already doing work to protect wildlife habitat and to create wildlife corridors. But it's being done a little bit in isolation. And so the idea is to bring all that good work happening together to set a clear set of priority areas, and then to make sure that we're putting the resources behind it so that the, you know, the projects actually, the shovels go in the ground, the projects actually go into place. So the work now is to make sure that this report doesn't sit on a shelf, but it goes into real projects that protect real wildlife.
And so what's the status at this point? So now it's going to move forward. Who's actually going to make those arrangements to have these projects move forward?
So that now is on the work of us as advocates. Uh-huh. You know, there's a lot on the governor's plate. There's a lot on the legislature's plate. For myself at Penn Environment, for your listeners, it's calling on their members of the legislature to take the recommendations of this report seriously. And so, for example, the state assembly, they can increase the amount that the Game Commission can spend to purchase land for conservation. Right now that's capped, and that limits the sort of land we can acquire as a state to reconnect game land. The assembly can also require state agencies, independent agencies, insurance contractors working in Pennsylvania to track and report animal vehicle collisions so that we can have a better sense of where these crossings need to be. Those are all things the legislature can do. And so we need to make sure that they understand, that our elected officials understand, this is a huge priority for us, protecting our wildlife, protecting drivers. And so by reaching out to your state legislators and asking them that this be a priority next session, that's going to really help sort of grease the wheels and get this rolling. You know, we know what we need to do, but now it's up to our elected officials and the government to start getting it off the ground.
Well, thank you so much for the update, Stephanie, and it's always a pleasure to have you back on our program.
Of course, yeah, I'm so glad to be here.
Let me turn to our second guest, Farron Savitz, Penn Environment's Zero Waste Advocate, working to reduce plastic waste in Pennsylvania and protect our parks and open spaces. Nice to have you join us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Last year, you spoke about microplastics in Pennsylvania waterways. Could you give an overview regarding the issue of plastic microplastic pollution and then update our listeners on the Plastic Pellets Free Waters Act?
Of course, I'd love to. I think the big thing when it comes to plastic pollution and microplastic pollution is just to think about how we see it in our daily lives. I'm sure most of us have seen a plastic bag trapped in a tree or litter on our streets, in our parks. Practically everywhere we look, we see litter and trash, and a lot of that are the plastic items we use in our daily lives. We see in the news photos of a turtle with a straw up its nose, a bird wrapped in plastic, six-pack rings trapping fish or dolphins. And plastic itself is a harm for our wildlife. It can entangle them, snare them, it can choke them, stop them from finding food. But the problem with plastic goes beyond this obvious visible litter that we all see. Plastic, unlike, say, an apple core or a piece of paper, never truly goes away. It's not going to biodegrade in our environment. Plastic just breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces of plastic. When they get to about 5 millimeters, which is around the size of a grain of rice, they become what's known as a microplastic. And they come in a bunch of different forms. Scientists have been finding these microplastics all around the world, practically. They've been found on our tallest mountains, in the deepest parts of our oceans. They've been found in our bodies and in the bodies of wildlife. They've been found in human lungs, in our brains, in our bloodstream. We know that our wildlife have microplastics in their bodies, things they eat in their environment or that they drink in and breathe in. At Penn Environment, we've done a lot of testing, too, for microplastic pollution around the state. We found microplastics in over 100 different waterways, rivers, lakes, and streams, including 50 of the cleanest, most pristine waterways in the state, several of which are in the Lehigh Valley, things like the Little Lehigh or Saucon Creek. And we know that these tiny microplastics harm wildlife, too. They can contain chemicals that work their way up the food chain to us, for sitting at the top of the food chain. So when we ingest these microplastics, either by eating, by breathing them in, by drinking them with our water, we're consuming these chemicals, too. And some of these microplastics aren't just the broken down pieces of plastic. Sometimes we produce plastic to be so small it's considered a microplastic. There are tiny plastic pellets that are the raw feedstock that goes into creating new plastic products. So a lot of the plastic we use in our daily lives, like a water bottle or a container, at one point were tiny little microplastic pellets that are sometimes called nurdles. And because these plastic pellets are so small, they get everywhere in the manufacturing process, in their transportation by rail or overseas. They spill. We dump trillions of tiny plastic pellets into our environment and our waterways every year, and it's a huge problem. But fortunately, there are solutions to this. This year, Congress has introduced the Plastic Pellet Free Waters Act, which would make it illegal to dump plastic pellets, to discharge them into our waterways, whether it's from a facility that produces plastic products from pellets, whether it's the trains that carry these pellets around. We'd be able to hold polluters accountable when they release this plastic pollution into our environment. It has a lot of support, bipartisan support, both Democrats and Republicans, including six of our representatives in Pennsylvania. But it's a great first step in ensuring that microplastic pollution gets cut off at the source. Microplastics are really small. That's what the name means. And so it can be really hard to tackle them once they're already in our environment. So if we can take these upstream solutions, stop it from becoming pollution, make sure that the people who are introducing microplastics into our environment are held accountable, we can actually make a dent in this problem, stop it from harming wildlife, stop it from harming our ecosystems, and stop the plastic from harming us. And there are other solutions, too, we can take. Things like local actions. Our townships, our boroughs, our cities can take action to cut plastic pollution off at the source. Things like plastic bag bans or restrictions on other types of single-use plastics are becoming more and more popular in Pennsylvania. There are currently, I believe, 34 bans on single-use plastics across Pennsylvania, including in our two largest cities, though there aren't any in the Lehigh Valley right now. And the more of these that we take at the local level, the more of these policies we can pass, the more plastic we can stop from getting into our waste stream, from getting littered, from breaking into microplastics, and from impacting our environment, our wildlife, and our health. And that's what it comes down to. These products are harmful to ecosystems, and they're sort of unnecessary when you think about it. We have easy alternatives to a lot of our single-use plastics. Things like a reusable bag for a plastic shopping bag, reusable bottles for plastic bottles, reusable containers, utensils, straws, it goes on and on, where if we can switch from sort of this single-use mindset, where the products we use we can dispose of and not really think about them again, if we get away from that way of thinking and think, well, even if I throw out this plastic, it could come around and harm us eventually. It could make its way to our waterways. It could break down into microplastics, which are going to impact us. And if we start to think instead, let's use something that can be reused, that doesn't become waste, that we are going to make use of over and over again, then we can make a really big impact in our lives and in the lives of everyone. And it really does start at the local level. It starts with us, but it can also happen through federal action, like the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act.
You mentioned that there have been instances, you know, where plastics, microplastics, et cetera, had been brought into the environment. So I do know there have been several train derailments within Pennsylvania, in fact, where plastics, microplastics have been spilled. For example, read about one where three trains were involved in collisions that derailed 9 rail cars and 2 locomotives in 2024 in Lower Saucon Township, spilling diesel fuel and polypropylene plastic pellets into the Lehigh River. And so you would think that would be of major concern. So what can a local citizen do? Yes, they can talk to their state legislators, but what else can they do?
Yeah, certainly with train derailments, it's an issue we're seeing around the country, but especially in Pennsylvania. There was that train derailment near Bethlehem that spilled plastic pellets into our environment. There have been train derailments east to west across Pennsylvania because so many of these plastic pellets get transported across our state from plastic producing facilities and everywhere else. So we're seeing more and more of these. A great thing people can do is, as you said, talk to their state representatives or talk to their members of Congress, their U.S. senators and representatives, and get them to support action like the Plastic Pellet Free Waters Act. If we can pass legislation like the Pellets Act, we can make sure that when train derailments happen, there are stricter penalties, the cleanups happen, and we can make sure they don't happen again so that these pellets aren't getting spilled into our environment and harming us right here locally. People can also take the lead at the local level. Certainly talking to your local council members, supervisors, commissioners, county officials about plastic pollution and litter, trying to get action at the local level, or just seeking ways to get rid of these plastics in our daily lives is a great way of doing it too. Also, there are things you can do in your own life, whether it's trying to minimize the microplastics coming from your clothing. A lot of the microplastics that enter our environment are from synthetic fabrics in the clothing we wear. Avoiding synthetic fabrics, focusing on natural fibers like cotton or wool is a great way to reduce our impact that way. And then also thinking about reuse. Where are things that can be repaired and fixed? Where are things that I can use something over and over again instead of throwing it out? What can I do in those little things is always a way to take actions, to make change. But again, the best things we can do are start upstream. Make sure that the solutions we take are bigger and are stopping this pollution from happening in the first place instead of trying to figure out what to do with it once it's already made.
Thank you for the update, Farron. It's been extremely informative.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guests are Stephanie Wine, Farron Savitz, and Flora Cardoni with Penn Environment Research and Policy Center, providing updates on several environment-related issues. Do stay tuned.
Thank you to the members of WDIY for making all the programming you hear possible. Becoming a WDIY member is the best way to support your listening and to ensure WDIY will be here for the next person in our community to discover. Make your membership gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 4 or wdiy.org. We couldn't be here without you.
Welcome back to the LCHAR Chronicles. Our discussion this evening is to provide our listeners with the latest updates on several environmental issues. We've addressed conservation connectivity, including wildlife corridors, with Stephanie Wine, and the Plastic Pellets Free Waters Act with Farron Savitz, both of Penn Environment Research and Policy Center. My third guest is Flora Cardoni, Deputy Director with Penn Environment, to provide an update on renewable energy projects such as wind and solar. So how does Pennsylvania fare in renewable energy?
Thank you so much for asking, Karen, and thank you for having me. Penn Environment Research and Policy Center actually just released a new report that shows that Pennsylvania is faring pretty abysmally in terms of renewable energy growth. In fact, our research shows that Pennsylvania ranks 48th in the nation for percentage of growth in total wind, solar, and geothermal energy over the past decade. You know, for the fifth most populous state in the nation is a pretty horrible ranking. And I think this really speaks to a larger issue at hand, where Pennsylvania only produces between about 3 to 4% of our energy from clean renewable sources. And so despite Pennsylvania's long legacy of being an energy leader, we are just continuing to fall more and more behind the national pace of renewable energy growth, which of course is horrible for our climate and our air and our health, but it's also causing the Commonwealth to miss out on some huge economic opportunities that the renewable energy economy offers. So this report looked at a lot of renewable energy sectors, the growth of 6 clean energy technologies across the nation over the past decade, which, as I mentioned, includes solar and wind and geothermal, as well as battery storage, energy efficiency, and electric vehicles, as well as EV charging stations. And while some renewables are rising in Pennsylvania, which I'll speak to more in a moment, it is clear that the Keystone State is growing our clean renewable energy at a much slower rate than most of the other states in the nation. As I mentioned, ranking 48th for growth in wind, solar, and geothermal over the past decade total. We're also 46th for solar alone, which is just a big problem. The science is very clear that to stop the worst impacts of climate change, we need to be transitioning away from dirty, dangerous fossil fuels towards a clean, renewable energy powered future. And that's not just important for our climate, but clean, renewable energy also means cleaner air and healthier communities. And as I mentioned, has a lot of economic opportunities as well. By Pennsylvania lagging behind with only about 3% of our energy coming from clean, renewable sources, we're really falling behind. In fact, a lot of our neighboring states have made a lot more progress. So Maryland, for example, requires 50% renewable energy by 2030. New Jersey, the same, 50% renewable energy by 2030. New York requires 70% renewable energy by 2030. And Washington, D.C. actually requires 100% renewable energy by 2032. Pennsylvania, on the other hand, only requires right now that 8% of our energy mix comes from clean renewable energy. And that's part of the reason that our clean energy growth here in the Commonwealth is so slow. There are ways that we can change that. So there is a proposal in the state legislature right now that was put forward with the governor working with clean energy leaders in the legislature that would really tackle this problem. So the governor's energy plan is House Bill 2277 and Senate Bill 1190, as well as companion bills, House Bill 2275 and Senate Bill 1191. Those are colloquially known as PRESS and PACER specifically. And those bills will dramatically increase the amount of renewable energy that is produced by energy companies that supply electricity in Pennsylvania over the next decade, as well as requiring major climate polluters to pay for their emissions that are causing climate change and making people sick. So at Penn Environment, one of our top priorities right now is building support for that legislation. The first bill that I mentioned, the governor's press proposal for House Bill 2277, Senate Bill 1190, is a bill that would increase Pennsylvania's alternative energy portfolio standards and increase the amount of clean renewable energy that electricity providers have to produce and provide to Pennsylvanians. Right now, our state's alternative energy portfolio standard actually flatlined in 2021 with about 8% of a requirement. And there are no longer any incentives to require energy to be increased, clean energy to be increased. Again, bad for our climate, bad for our environment, bad for our health. But it's also leaving Pennsylvania pretty vulnerable in terms of grid reliability and dependency. And so this bill would increase that tier, requiring 35% of the energy being provided by electricity utilities to include more renewable energy sources like solar and wind and geothermal. There's a ton of support for that bill in the legislature right now, and it's really key for not only helping Pennsylvania come into the 21st century in terms of a clean energy economy, but will also really help us, again, improve reliability and dependency of the grid. So we definitely are encouraging all of our legislators on both sides of the aisle to support that bill and help us move from, you know, the 20th century into the 21st. The other thing that our bill or our recent report shows is that Pennsylvania is making a little bit better progress in terms of electric vehicles. We've actually seen more than a 4,000% increase in electric vehicle registration since 2013. So we're about 14th in the nation in terms of EV registrations. And we've also seen the number of EV charging ports increase. We're now 11th in the nation there. Those numbers are expected to grow even more as Pennsylvanians take advantage of tax credits and rebates offered in the Inflation Reduction Act for new and used electric vehicles. And there are a ton of incentives available in the Inflation Reduction Act, not just for electric vehicles, but other clean energy as well. So if you're listening at home, of course, I encourage you to talk to your elected officials about increasing the amount of clean renewable energy in the state. But at the same time, there are ways that you can make your own choices to help you save money and save the environment at the same time. So the Inflation Reduction Act was truly a historic moment in terms of investments in clean energy. It was the largest investment in clean energy and energy efficiency that's ever been passed in history. And there's a ton of money in the forms of tax credits and incentives that'll make it easier and more affordable for Pennsylvanians themselves to put solar on their roofs or to buy a newer used electric vehicle or to install an electric vehicle charger, to get a water heater or heat pump, an induction stove, improve energy efficiency in your home, and more. So we don't need to wait for the state to act. I certainly encourage everyone to check out what's available to them through the Inflation Reduction Act. I do think that will help Pennsylvania begin to take more advantage of the clean energy that's at our fingertips. And certainly the growth of EVs is showing that that's starting to happen. And as more individuals, houses of worship, businesses, nonprofits take advantage of those Inflation Reduction Act incentives, we should help see more clean energy being brought in online in the Commonwealth than ever before. But again, individuals' action is not enough. We need the state of Pennsylvania to keep up with its neighbors, increase the state's alternative energy portfolio standard, and just increase the amount of clean, renewable energy that our utilities are required to provide if we're really going to clean up our air, protect our health, and fight climate change, and make sure that current and future generations of Pennsylvanians have a livable climate to call home.
You mentioned, obviously, electric vehicles, and I believe you recently issued a new interactive map regarding where one can find places to charge your vehicles in association with state and national parks, which I also found very interesting. Yes. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Totally, yes. This is pretty exciting. We released an interactive map earlier this summer that shows where Pennsylvanians and Americans can charge their electric vehicles while enjoying nature. So in part because of the money in the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure Investment and Job Act, there's a lot more money for electric vehicle charging stations. And in fact, PennDOT is working on a whole plan to put electric vehicle charging stations along interstates and highways all across the Commonwealth to give people a little bit more confidence in where they charge their cars. But DCNR specifically has worked to install electric vehicle chargers at roughly 36 state parks and forests across the state. Our interactive map highlights those, as well as more than 260 large state and national parks across the country. We thought this was really interesting on the one hand because transportation is our number one source of climate pollution in the country, and shifting to electric vehicles can lower that climate pollution as well as cleaning up our air and protecting our health. And at the same time, we know that by electrifying our transportation, cleaning up our air, fighting climate change, it's really important to helping the health of our forests and ecosystems and really just helping to make sure America's most beloved natural places can maintain their character and their beauty. So I think this is a cool way to show that, you know, by electrifying our transportation, we can lower our air and climate pollution, which benefits our parks, but we can also charge our cars at these parks while we're recreating, getting outside, and enjoying the great open spaces that Pennsylvanians have to offer. With more places to recharge EVs, you know, we think that will really help us build a cleaner energy future, but also help people feel a little bit more confident that there are chargers where they need them to be so they can, you know, actually make the switch.
Well, it's quite heartening to know there's been forward movement on a number of environmental issues. So thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
My guests have been Flora Cardoni, Deputy Director with Penn Environment Research and Policy Center, and staff Stephanie Wine, Clean Water and Conservation Advocate, and Farron Savitz, Zero Waste Advocate. For more information on these and other environment-related issues, visit pennenvironment.org. This is Karen Elchar. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to WDIY, and we'll see you next time on the Elchar Chronicles. We'll be right back.